It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Anne Strainchamps. Today, the mayor. Poverty, climate change, unemployment. Name a problem, and Washington seems unable to solve it. Immigration, education, enter the mayor. Pragmatic, problem-solving, nonpartisan, mayors just might be the next best hope for democracy. That's according to political theorist Benjamin Barber. The title of his recent book puts it right on the line, If Mayors Ruled the World. Steve Paulson caught up with him at a Chicago conference on cities and sustainability.
Ben, why do you think we'd be better off if mayors ruled the world?
Well, we'd be better off if almost anybody else ruled the world than the people who are ruling it, which is the CEOs of giant carbon corporations and financial banks, which have no interest in public goods, which is the leaders of nation states stuck in ideology and embedded in their sovereignty and unable to cooperate. So you might say that almost anybody would be an alternative. I argue that mayors in particular, however, are efficient, pragmatic problem solvers, closer to their people, more democratic, and indeed, since cities today have over half of the world's population in them, in the Western world it's actually 80%, cities really are democratically representative of the world's population, and mayors are already cooperating with one another across borders and dozens of intercity organizations and global organizations. So in every way, mayors are better positioned, more capable of, and more interested in solving real human problems. It's all about real stuff. Real stuff. And if mayors don't do the real stuff, forget the rest. And it doesn't matter whether they're right or left, Republican or Democrat, Labor or Tory, mayors don't and can't afford to take sides. You can't as mayor say, I'm a union guy, don't talk to business, or I'm a business guy, don't talk to unions. You got to talk to both. You need a coalition. You need people to work with you. So mayors are problem solvers, they're pragmatists, and they're also neighbors. And what's interesting is that the trust level in politicians around the world at the national and state level is really poor. We know the Congress of the United States has dropped to an 8% trust rating. But if you ask people, do you trust your mayors, your city councilors, the trust levels are still at 70 and 75%, which is remarkable in these cynical times. So you might say urban democracy, municipal democracy, is the only place where people still really believe in democracy.
What about the big problems out there, whether it's crime or unemployment or a global problem like climate change? Is more effective action going to happen at the level of cities?
Well, again, cities are dealing with these issues for two reasons. One, because they have to, because the states aren't. And the second, because they can and they're well positioned to do so. Even an issue which most people associate with the national government, immigration, the national government sets these standards for who can and who can't cross the border. But we know in the United States and Europe and all over the world, the great number of immigrants who cross borders cross illegally. They become undocumented residents of countries in which they have no right technically to be, but in which the logic of the global economy with jobs draws them. In the United States, we've got almost 12 million undocumented immigrants who are living here with families and so forth, and cities are in a position of saying, what are we going to do about them? The national government says they don't exist, and if they find them, they throw them out. And meanwhile, they live in great numbers. 10-15% of urban population is made up of these immigrants. Mr. de Blasio of New York recently, in his State of the City, just announced he was going to make available city IDs, what some people call city visas, to every resident of New York who wants it. Doesn't matter whether they're documented, undocumented, immigrant, born New Yorker. You will get that ID. You'll be on the books. Your kids can go to school. You can get jobs. You can get medical care. The police will know who you are and what your address is so they can keep track of you and so forth.
So he's basically sidestepping the whole immigration debate in Congress.
He's saying, look, you guys aren't doing anything. You're frozen. And there are 12 million people here who are, quote, illegal, but they're here, and you're not telling us what to do with them. Well, we'll take the decision. We'll do it. My own belief is if enough cities do that, you'll find a soft road to full citizenship status, because a desperate government looking for a way to deal with the reality of undocumented workers will say, well, if they live for 5 or 10 years with a city visa in a city and live according to the law, maybe that's a good way to give them, put them on the road to national citizenship. But whether or not that happens doesn't matter. Immigration is an issue cities can and will deal with because they have to and because they can.
obstacles.
So when you look around the world, I mean, you know, you've studied cities around the world. I'm sure there are lots of cities that are doing things well, but two or three model cities that kind of jump out at you, well, this is how it should be done.
In Europe, Hamburg is an amazing city. It's just declared the first green capital of Europe. It does wind turbines in the city. It has zero emission buses. It has a program of compact communities in which you look for density and then put green spaces around them rather than the sort of massive spread that you have in so many American cities. So Hamburg is a place that's doing all these things, but it's doing it with a mayor who understands you can't do it at the expense of economic development. So he's working very hard to show that a sustainable economy and a prosperous economy are not incompatible, that you can do, if you find the right policies, you can do both at the same time. So Hamburg is a great example. Singapore, which is another city-state, well, some people have problems with a rather authoritarian government, although that's loosening up over time, has, in terms of housing policy and environmental policy, been a global leader. The housing system there allows people to buy subsidized housing and then resell it and keep the profits. And it allows people, when they're young, to have a one or two room. When they have families, the three or four room. When they get old, to stay in the same building and move to a one or two room. Again, the private development industry benefits because they build the housing. The population benefits because they're the ones to whom the housing is sold, and they own it, and they make the profits when it's sold. And everybody has a sense of place. Families stay together in the same building. It's been a very, very successful policy being imitated now in other cities around the world.
Well, let me ask you about Detroit. I mean, if there is a poster child of what not to do in a city, it would seem to be Detroit, which recently went bankrupt.
And totally wrong. I mean, that is to say, that perception, obviously it did go bankrupt. That's not wrong. Why it went bankrupt is because of the way in which we define our cities. Detroit and many other cities were, in the United States, founded in the 18th and 19th century. And, of course, back then, the city limits were very narrow. Detroit, inside its old city limits, is one thing. That's a city that, in 1950, was the fourth largest city in the United States with 2 million people and all of the automobile industry located there. Very, very successful city. Within 40 years, it had lost two-thirds of its population. It's under 700,000 today. Half its schools, parks shut down. Terrible problem. And you say, so what, doesn't that show that, you know, Detroit and other old industrial cities can't make it? But here's the reality. The reality is the 10 counties around Detroit that make up the actual Detroit today, the greater Detroit metropolitan region, served by Detroit's cultural institutions, served by its universities, served by its transportation system. Those 10 counties, while Detroit was shrinking, went from 3 to 5 million people. A lot of the industry that left downtown Detroit settled in those counties around it. And those counties today are the fourth most advanced, prosperous, new tech zone in the United States. And if you count that as Detroit, Detroit's not bankrupt. It's one of the most successful areas of America with a downtown area that has some problems that you got to deal with. But right now, the downtown area is in effect hived off, left with no resources, told to take care of itself, while all the counties that it created and whose prosperity came from Detroit in the city are off on their own, enjoying their resources, enjoying their tax revenues, but not taking responsibility. So a lot of places have that problem. They are narrowly defined by old jurisdictional boundaries, which no longer comport with the reality of how America's zones are drawn and the areas where people live and this and what they serve. New York City serves, with its transportation system, with its arts and culture, and with its financial industry, serves an area of about 30 or 40 million people. But it's reliant on the 8 million inside the five boroughs for its revenues, for its support, and so forth. And that's crazy. I mean, it's a really screwed up thing, and we really need a fundamental redefinition, a reboundarying of our cities. And to get that, you know, what you need is an urban party. You need citizens saying, wait a minute. So redrawing jurisdictional boundaries of cities is a big, big aim and objective for a smart mayors today.
Benjamin Barber is the author of If Mayors Ruled the World. Steve Paulson talked with him. Okay, That's the big picture. But how does city democracy work, really work, when you get down to the nitty-gritty ground floor level? In Chicago's 49th Ward, Cecilia Salinas works for Alderman Joe Moore as his participatory budgeting coordinator. That's a really big title. What it means is she works with the residents of the 49th Ward to help them decide how to spend their ward's money. Under participatory budgeting, or PB, the alderman has turned his discretionary funds, called his menu money, over to them.
Basically, every alderman in Chicago is in charge of what they call menu money, $1.3 million that every alderman in Chicago, there are 50 of them, have discretionary money and decisions with this money.
And what do they usually use it for?
Basically, the menu money is to use it in infrastructure projects, capital improvements.
So this is like making sure the streets don't have huge potholes in them.
Yes, street resurfacing, street lights, sidewalks, speed humps.
Did your office decide to just open up all that money, the $1.3 million, to participatory budgeting?
During the first year, it was done that way. But right after the first year, the first PB cycle finish was done, they felt that they need to have to reserve some money aside, so to pay with the overruns or emergencies, because it's the only money that they have,
right,
that he has. It's only $1 million since 2011.
How does this process actually work, opening the budget up to the public? I mean, I'm imagining a scene like one of those town hall meetings in Parks and Rec, you know, with everybody just yelling at each other.
No, it's not that way. It doesn't work that way, no. It's a very labor intense because you need to prepare the community each year. So we held usually a total of nine assemblies, six in English, one in Spanish, and two of them are for high school students.
And what happens at those?
And these assemblies, we present, we have a presentation about what is PB and what we have done with PB, with the PB project so far. And then we divide the room in, usually it's three or four groups, depends of the attendance. And then we have facilitators that are also members from the community. And then we explore ideas, new ideas. And then we have a big meeting when we call all the volunteers that sign up at these assemblies to follow up with these ideas and develop the projects during the next 3 or 4 months. And then they present all these ideas that are ready for the ballot, to be ready for the votes.
So for the votes, does everybody in the whole community vote? I mean, anybody who wants to? It's not just people who've been to the assemblies or people who are on subgroups?
No. Everybody in the community, and this is, I think this is the beauty of this process, every resident of the 49th Ward is allowed to vote, regardless their citizen status, immigration status, and if he's 16 years or older.
What kind of ideas has the neighborhood voted to fund so far? And how different are they from, say, what your staff might have funded?
When we have the menu money spent before this process, it was mainly done through lights, used through street lights, street resurfacing, sometimes sidewalks and some alleys. Mm-hmm. But during the first year of participatory budgeting, we have like 24 projects, from doggy parks to solar garbage containers to beach showers, playground, community garden, 32 murals.
32 murals, wow.
In 2010, the community voted for 30 murals. And then in 2012, the community felt that there were some viaducts that need to be decorated. So they vote for more.
So you've got a lot more colorful district than you used to have.
Oh, yeah, yeah. It's beautiful to see it. And also, we want to attract other people in the city and make them possible. You know, we have these murals. And so it's really colorful and vibrant. So, yeah, it's really interesting.
So it sounds like participatory budgeting has made the kinds of things and the kinds of projects you take on more imaginative, more creative.
Yes. Yes, they are more creative. We're trying to look for this. So through the years, they have been very creative. And I think this is the makes a, like a, it's like a refreshment to the community to see. It's not a cookie cutter process. So you don't know what is going to happen, what kind of projects are going to come up in the next cycle. You'll never know.
Do you think this process has changed how people in the neighborhood feel about their government?
I think so. It has changed and has educated the people in the community because they are more aware of how things are being made, how the process is. And also not only the community, the city. Because the city has also has to change on the way that they do the process to make things happen.
What do you
in
mean?
The community. You know, sometimes we tend to say that the city in different places, it's city governments are more bureaucratic and things take more time than others. So with this process, we have been making them thinking that they have to find more creative ways to do things quicker.
Another plus I can imagine, I'm just trying to think about what it would feel like if my neighborhood was run this way. And I'm imagining people would start gradually to have a greater sense of ownership of their neighborhood. You know, if you've helped make the decision that, you know, that sidewalk's going to be replaced or that bike path is going to be put in, you might, I don't know, feel like you want to do a little more to maintain it.
Yes, we have found that too. And this is it's a beautiful thing because the people has a more sense of community. They feel more incorporated and they feel like they have been heard. And this is very important. They also participate more in different ways.
Like what?
Oh, if they weren't in PPE, in working with us, volunteering for PPE, they also decided to also get involved with parks. They have been, they became members of park advisory councils.
So they get pulled into other parts of civic life.
Yes.
Great.
Yeah, it's really interesting.
That's fascinating. Thank you so much for telling us about it.
Thank you for having me.
Cecilia Salinas is the Participatory Budgeting Coordinator for Joe Moore, the alderman for Chicago's 49th Ward, the Rogers Park neighborhood. I'm Ann Strainchamps. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. There's only one mayor I know personally, and that's my neighbor, Mayor Dave. He's actually the former mayor of Madison, Wisconsin, and his real name is Dave Cheslevich, but everyone still calls him Mayor Dave. One of his big heroes is the late urban thinker Jane Jacobs. She lived in Toronto, and when Dave told us he was headed there for a conference and was planning on visiting her old neighborhood, we gave him a tape recorder.
I was a street musician on the corner of Barthurst and Bloor Street in Jane Jacobs' neighborhood. So Jane Jacobs lives in a pretty funky neighborhood. I'm standing here on the corner of Bloor and Barthurst Streets, and I'm looking at the Green Beanery coffee shop, no doubt shade growing. Next to it, the Insomnia Martini Lounge looks very new age, very upscale. Next to that, Alibaba's Middle Eastern cuisine. Does not look so upscale. And next to that, Dragonfly Belly Dance. So I would say we're here at the frontier between a little run down and the invading hordes of yuppies. So now we're walking down Albany Street. This is Jane Jacobs Street, the street where she lives. The corner of Albany and Bloor. There's a Starbucks. I'm not sure how Jane Jacobs would feel about Starbucks.
Dave, why Jane Jacobs? What made you want to go in search of her?
Well, if you're a mayor, Jane Jacobs sort of wrote the Bible. She wrote a book in 1962 called The Death and Life of Great American Cities, and it really set the world on fire. She challenged every prevailing view about what good planning was, what good transportation policy was. She basically said, look, cities have neighborhoods. Neighborhoods are really complex, sometimes messy places, and we should appreciate cities for really what they are. And she really asked herself, well, how does a city actually function day to day? What makes a city an interesting place? Jane Jacobs really set the tone for the way we think about cities today.
You asked a question a minute ago. You asked if Jane Jacobs would have approved of the Starbucks in her neighborhood. What do you think? And what do you think of Starbucks?
Well, it's a philosophical question that we can all wrestle with. I think she probably would have been okay with it, because what she was about really was about mixing it up on the street, giving people an opportunity for all of those unplanned interactions that people have that actually turn out to be the basis for today's creative economy. You know, engineers meeting artists and architects talking to lawyers and doctors talking to dancers and all of those weird connections that you get in a city. That's what makes a city an interesting place, is that you have these concentrations of people from all different kinds of backgrounds, and they get together and they mix it up, and they come up with all kinds of art and products and commerce, and they create families with interesting children and all this stuff, simply because they ran into each other in a city. And the thing about a Starbucks is, and maybe I might like a locally owned coffee shop more, but the thing about a Starbucks is it's a place like that. It's what we sometimes call a third place, where people come and mix it up. So I think Jane Jacobs would be okay with a Starbucks.
Okay. Well, let's hear a bit more of the tape from your Toronto tour.
Name, please.
Alicia Liang.
What do you do?
I am a transportation planner.
Does Toronto have soul?
I believe Toronto has soul, yes.
How do you define soul?
A place with vibrancy, a place where people gather on the streets, where everyone feels comfortable on the streets.
And Toronto has that?
I think Toronto does.
Okay, such a great question. When does a city have soul?
Well, if you could answer that question, I think it's the sort of question you really can't answer flat out. I think you just feel it. It's really very intuitive. I mean, think about how you feel when you go into a big suburban shopping mall, right? You walk in, it's a comfortable place, right? I mean, the temperature is controlled and there are the stores you want. You go and buy stuff. But do you really feel like you're in a particular place? Do you really feel like, hey, I could be in a shopping mall in Cleveland or Los Angeles or Milwaukee. It doesn't matter. And then how do you feel when you're in a place like here in Madison? It would be State Street. In New York, it would be maybe Greenwich Village. How do you feel when you're there? Do you get a sense of place? Do you get a sense that this is unique and different from every other place that I've been? People know when they're in a place that works, and they know when they're in a place that doesn't.
And so what's the role of the mayor in making a city vibrant?
I think a mayor simply needs to understand his or her city, sort of get the vibe of the place and how it works and how it functions. I still tell aspiring politicians, there's no better job, no better public job than mayor. I would have rather been mayor than governor or president any day of the week, because you can get stuff done. Mayors deal in tangible things, and their constituents want them to be there, and you get immediate feedback. If you're doing something right, people shout out in the street, thanks, Mayor, nice job. If you're not doing something right, you hear other things. And so it's immediate, it's tangible, you're very close. And what I tell aspiring politicians is, I would want to be mayor if I were you, but keep this in mind, it is the most personal and intimate of public roles. When
people are voting for congressperson or senator, it's sort of abstract. But when they're voting for mayor, they're looking at you and they're asking themselves, can I see that person representing me? Can I see that person speaking for me? Can I see that person sort of reflecting what my city is about? It's deeply personal. And so you make this connection with people and with the city that really you don't get a chance to make in any other political job anyplace else.
Well, you just made me want to be a mayor.
You should be a mayor. Everybody should be a mayor.
Dave Cheslevich was the mayor of Madison, Wisconsin from 2003 to 2011. Mayor Dave, as he's still known, is currently the executive director of the Wisconsin Bike Federation. That's the recognizable voice of the Icelandic pop star Björk. For a lot of people around the world, Björk is Iceland. But the country has a new celebrity these days, the mayor of Reykjavik. His name is John Gnarr. He's a professional comedian. He ran for mayor as a lark and, to his surprise, won. He just completed a 4-year term and published a memoir, and Charles Monroe Kane talked with him about his unorthodox style as mayor and the absurd campaign that got him elected.
I don't know what the phrase equivalent in Iceland is for smartass, but it was such a smartass campaign. I couldn't believe some of the stuff you tried to do. I was reading some of the stuff you talked about. One of my favorites was you wanted to make a replica of the Statue of Liberty in the form of Bjork holding a microphone instead of a torch. You promised everyone a free towel and that there would be a polar bear in the zoo. You even promised to break every one of your promises. There's no way you expected to win, did you?
Well, no, not at the beginning. I just saw it as fun, but then realized that that's exactly what people were so thirsty for.
Right.
So, in a way, my joke was on me, really. And I just tried to be as absurd as possible in the campaign and you know, come up with the most ridiculous promises and slogans.
What do you think is the most ridiculous one you came up with, the one you're most proud of?
I guess the Björk statue was the most surrealistic idea promise.
It's too bad it didn't happen.
Yeah, because I think it would make a great statue. I mean, with artificial intelligence, so it could, like, look down at people and talk directly to people and, like, with laser beams from her eyes and, like, quote Björk songs and also information about Iceland and Reykjavik.
I noticed online when I searched for you, not only does Björk come up, but she talks about you. It's a small country. What did she think of your campaign? Did she do anything for it? I know you made a rock video. She wasn't in it. Well, mm-hmm. How did she feel about it? And would she have stood for hours to get sculpted around, you know, to make a statue?
No, I don't think so.
I don't think so, right?
No, but she's been very... she's been happy with the best party. I mean, it is the best possible party, so...
And the best party, of course, is the political party that you created around you. The best party. What was your slogan? You had a great slogan.
No, it's just simply the best.
It's a great slogan. We're the best. We're not going to keep any of our campaign promises, and we're the best.
Anything else is rubbish. Vote for the best.
Now, there must have been a moment in your life. I want you to take us back to May 28th, 2010. This is the eve of your election. You're the 21st mayor of Reykjavik, by far the most powerful, most important city in your country. Mm-hmm. You must have been like, holy crap. Now what am I going to do? Because you can't just keep a joke going that long. It can't be absurd. You've got to run a city. You've got to help people out. There's problems. Iceland had had major economic collapse. Well, what was going through your head?
Well, it's probably similar to when I had my first kid. A time of great fun, but suddenly there's a kid, there's a child, and you have to take care of it, and it brings with it a lot of responsibility. And I, of course, asked myself, what have I gotten myself into now? And I couldn't get it all in at once. It took me took me a while to realize what the nature of my job was. But I decided to tackle it like any other job that I've done in my life.
The more conservative people in your country, and certainly the people who lost power because of you and as a very powerful position you had, mm-hmm. they must have been waiting for you to see what you're going to do. And you did one of the most absurd things I've ever heard of in my life in politics. Immediately after getting elected, you made an announcement that you would not enter a coalition government with anyone who had not watched the entire HBO series The Wire. Are you serious?
No.
You must have blown their minds, man.
Oh, I'm so proud of that. I just liked the idea, you know, how they would react to this. I mean, would they actually go and buy the series and watch it? No, I was just teasing them, you know, to see what they would do.
So meanwhile, you're messing with them, right? You're doing some absurd stuff.
Uh-huh.
First thing you decide to tackle as mayor is the budget. You came in. You raised taxes, you restructured with your own idea the education system of the entire city, mm-hmm. you laid off the electricity utility workers that you thought were redundant,
uh-huh.
and then you did another thing after doing all that. You balanced the budget for the first time in Reykjavik's history. You balanced the budget and then ended up having extra money mm-hmm. to do other projects. Man, you are an absurdist comedian and a punk rocker, mm-hmm. and you balanced the budget in the first year in office. How the hell did you do that?
Somehow it relies and depends on humbleness and serenity, I suppose. In my experience, it brings out the best in people who are working with you. And once people realize that you respect them and trust them, And in my experience, it's the same element of creating a good band compared to a bad band. mm-hmm. It has a lot to do with the chemistry between people to spot what different people have to offer to the table.
You were serious and you did balance the budget, but at your budget meetings, you would show up wearing a Jedi outfit
yeah.
to fight the guys who were against your side of the budget. You gave speeches in lipstick. You came to work in drag. If you thought a meeting was boring, you would put on a gorilla mask and just leave.
Yeah. When I feel like, you know, dressing up in drag, I do. I dress up in drag because that's how I feel, what I want to do. And with a lipstick, it was when I had been in office for 6 months, my mother died. And it was in the middle of the budget making and I didn't even have time to go through it to mourn my mother or anything. And the one thing I really loved about my mom was her ashtray and her smoking and her lipstick. And that's how I remember her putting on lipstick and smoking. So I just wanted, you know, from the estate, I just wanted the ashtray and her lipstick. And so I took up smoking and I put on her lipstick, you know, as a respect to the memory of my mother. And with the costumes, it's also about, you know, surprise. And the best party is a surprise party. It's like when you come home and all your friends are there and there's all call, yeah, surprise, surprise. But it's just for that moment, you know. They cannot leave the room again and come back and say, surprise, it's not a surprise anymore. It's just a moment. And people really appreciate surprises. And you know, when they're hopeless and gloomy, it's always nice to have a surprise. And what's more surprise than the mayor with a gorilla mask?
You're right. No, I can't think of anything more. Right. Good point.
So it made people smile, and when people smile, they get maybe some of the hope they had lost. And so it's just fun, and why not? Why shouldn't we all
right.
wear gorilla masks at budget meetings? I mean, especially when you're cutting down the budget.
And in the end, of course, the big question: what about the free towels at the pool and the polar bear in the zoo? Did you deliver?
No.
Oh man.
Ha 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 ha!
so stare. Mayor John Gnarr's memoir is called How I Became the Mayor of a Large City in Iceland and Changed the World. Charles Monroe Kane talked with him. And that's it for our conversation about mayors. Coming up, a story of mass hysteria in a small Texas town. I'm Ann Strainchamps. It's to the best of our knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. And now it's time for A Dangerous Idea.
Hi, I'm Harriet Brown, science writer, professor of magazine journalism at Syracuse University, and author of Body of Truth, How Science, History, and Culture Drive Our Obsession with Weight and What We Can Do About It. And my dangerous idea is, what if we simply stopped talking about how we look? How we look, how other people look, how we should look, how we wish we looked and we didn't look. What if we just stopped doing that? What if instead we talked about more important things like, I don't know, what we're achieving, what we're doing in school and in work and what we're doing to make the world a better place? What if we took all the energy that we now spend focusing on appearance, on weight, on beauty, all that stuff, and just used it for good? I really think the world could be a much better place, and I think it would be better for us individually. So when you meet someone, a friend you haven't seen for a while, instead of saying, wow, you look really good, have you lost weight? Or, oh, I see you're still struggling with that. Or, oh, gosh, you look so great, I'm just so fat, or, you know, my hair is a mess or whatever. Instead, what if we said something like, I don't know, have you seen the new park in town? Let's go take a walk there. You know, I'm really interested in the plight of songbirds. I'm taking guitar lessons. Whatever it is that you're doing that you're passionate about, I think that would lead to a much more interesting conversation. Because what happens when we focus so much on appearance is we're reinforcing the fact that we all feel self-conscious about it. We're also telling each other and ourselves and our children especially that that's the first thing that we're going to talk about. That's the most important thing about you. And especially for women in this culture, we have historically been so defined by and limited by appearance that I think it's important that we push past that. Think of it as a kind of revolution. I'm not going to be defined by appearance. This is how I look. It's the least interesting thing about me, I'm going to focus on other things. Maybe I could solve, I don't know, world peace or cure cancer or something.
That's A Dangerous Idea from writer Harriet Brown. So this week we've been thinking about The Unraveling of Mercy Lewis, the second novel from Kea Parsonen. The setting is Friday Night Lights, Texas, a small town where the local sports team is everything, except in this case, it's the girls' team. Mercy Lewis is the star of the championship girls' basketball team. She's the local golden girl. But then strange things start to happen. Mercy develops uncontrollable tics and twitches, and whatever she has, it spreads to the other girls. And then it gets worse. There are girls fainting or having seizures or grunting like animals and rolling on the ground. And people begin to worry that the town's teenage girls have been possessed. The fascinating part is that the book was inspired by a real-life case of mass hysteria. Kea read about it in a New York Times article about a high school in upstate New York.
And it turns out that 18 young women and one young man developed these involuntary physical and verbal tics, and it sort of set the town alight. They didn't know what to make of it. It sent everyone into a bit of a panic. And I just thought, well, how fascinating to dig into that material and figure out what would happen in a fictional town, and particularly what would happen within these families. The article talks about how parents and children would cry over the dinner table because they were just so baffled and so scared by what was happening to the girls. And so for me, that was a real opening when I got to sort of the personal side of that story.
Well, I was really surprised to find out that cases of mass hysteria, or I guess the technical term now is mass psychogenic illness, but they're not all that uncommon.
No, they're not. People think of it as sort of a Victorian lady disease, and it's not uncommon. And in fact, what I found particularly interesting about these outbreaks is they tend to happen among populations of disempowered young women. And that's certainly the case in my novel.
So what happens in your fictional town? How does this mass hysteria begin?
Well, it begins with, unlike with the case in Leroy, where there was sort of no catalyzing incident that people could sort of point the finger to and say, oh, this started things off. In Port Sabine, they discover a fetus in a dumpster, and this is right across the street from the high school. And so sort of in the minds of the townspeople immediately, the girls, the high school girls, are suspect. Mm-hmm. Because they think, well, who would be that desperate but a high school girl who's trying to sort of cover up that she's been having sex or got pregnant.
So the witch hunt begins.
Exactly. And so things sort of build to a crisis point over the summer, with rumors flying and suspicions. And that's when the physical tics start to manifest, when the stress becomes too much for the girls of the town.
Mm-hmm. Could you read a bit from one of the sections when the girls are very publicly kind of falling apart to get across the sense of the weirdness and the creepiness of what happens?
Sure. At halftime, Illa watches the dancing girls march onto the floor to the frenetic drums of the blaring techno music. The girls' red lipstick and blue eyeshadow look garish under the gym's lights. Or maybe it's just the extreme discomfort radiating out from behind their wide smiles. A minute into the routine, Abby collapses, followed quickly by Marilee. Illa gasps. When the girls hit the floor, they judder like junkies, and a few of the others trip over them, toppling to join the tangle of shiny limbs. A police officer rushes onto the court and kneels beside Abby, her blonde hair spilled onto the floor behind her. Someone cuts the music, and the crowd can hear the animal sounds coming from Marilee's lipstick's mouth. In the stands, people get on their feet, straining to see what's going on. That night, Illa doesn't sleep. In her head, as on the television news, she replays again and again the image of the two dancers falling, sequins flashing, mouths agape, looking like beautiful, broken dolls.
Wow. That's a powerful scene. And it all plays out on this basketball court, right?
That's right, yeah.
Yeah, so we haven't talked about that. Illa, the narrator in that section, is the manager of this girls' basketball team. Why that setting?
Well, it's interesting. So in the real-life case in Leroy, the girls who initially developed the symptoms were cheerleaders. And these symptoms tend to develop among women or girls who have very close relationships, and they tend to start with an alpha female. And I was completely unfamiliar with the world of cheerleading, but I had played basketball in high school, and I thought, well, you know, you don't really read much about girls' sports, girls' high school sports. So I thought, how cool would it be to have a heroine who's kind of this basketball badass? And that's where Mercy Lewis comes in. So it was a setting that I knew very well, that I was comfortable writing, but also that I thought hadn't been explored very much in a fictional setting. So I thought it would be nice to depict some female athletes on the page.
Yeah. The other thing about a lot of these cases of mass hysteria, they're almost always teenage girls. And I think that one of the reasons I think is that we put teenage girls in such an impossible position these days. You know, they're supposed to be like the cheerleaders, incredibly sexy, but at the same time, as in the girls in this town, they're supposed to be innocent and certainly not sexual. So we want them to be both, which is, mm-hmm. I think, part of why the girls sometimes just can't take the pressure. And it comes out in the form of mass hysteria.
Yes, absolutely. I think it's a form of expression that young women use when there's no other means to sort of call attention to trauma or stress in their lives. It's sort of you know, they've been pushed to a breaking point. And I do think there's just so many conflicting messages we send to teen girls, and they just don't have the perspective that, you know, adult women, who many of whom still receive those conflicting messages. I mean, I didn't grow up in the purity culture as Mercy does, where, you know, they have purity balls to celebrate a girl's virginity. And even though I wasn't raised in that culture, I still felt like sex was what bad girls did, that mm-hmm. good girls were not sexually active. And so, you know, it's just something that's part of our cultural makeup, I think.
Do you think we're afraid of teenage girls?
I think we are. I think that they, particularly 17, 18, older teenagers, as they're becoming adults, they're really on the cusp of owning their sexuality and, you know, not physically not being in, you know, their parents' house any longer. And there's something that's very threatening about that. And I think we find particularly threatening this idea that a young woman might not just have sex, but might actually enjoy having sex. I mean, that's like too much. That's beyond the pale. And I just find that so strange, because I remember being a teenage girl, an 18-year-old girl, in love with my longtime boyfriend, and still feeling like, well, sex is just something you don't do, you know? And I just wonder, well, why did I think that? I mean, obviously, it was just like I'd been brainwashed for so many years to feel like it was not acceptable.
Well, you wrote in a wonderful essay that there was a fair amount of rage that fueled this book for you, that you wrote it, what did you say, in a flaming nova of fury over over some of this. You sound very calm and collected right now, but what was the rage about?
Well, it was the election season, and the 2012 election was reaching a fever pitch. And I live in Missouri, and Todd Akin was saying all kinds of horrible things about legitimate rape and definitely trying to place limits on decisions women can make for themselves. And the Steubenville and Maryville rape cases had happened also around the time that I was just starting this book. And so I was just sort of at my limits. I had been pushed to the limit. I was just like, what country am I living in? I felt like I didn't recognize the United States. And it's a bit jarring to me every time I'm reminded that, in fact, there's a lot of sort of tribalism and cultural limitations placed on women in this country that are sort of disguised and in that way more insidious.
And you were also pregnant at the time, too. So thinking about women's reproductive rights must have felt very personal.
Very much so. Yeah, maybe I was incredibly hormonal at the time, too. That could have played into my rage. But I definitely felt like it was the most important decision I'd ever made in my life, and the one that would have the largest impact on my life so far in terms of deciding to get pregnant and deciding to have the baby. And so I just thought, for any person, for any man, for any politician to be able to say, you know, when and how I have my child, that just feels so wrong.
Well, I don't know what your experience of pregnancy was, but there was a part, especially during my first pregnancy, I felt like my body had partly been invaded. I mean, I wanted this baby, but I felt like my body wasn't just my own anymore. And I found that disturbing. It took me a while to get used to it.
Absolutely. It's very unsettling. And it's like your body is not your own anymore. Literally, there is someone else in there. But also the way that you become sort of this public spectacle for other people who want to touch, they want to advise, they want to sort of invade your sphere.
Yes, the personal questions people will feel, perfect strangers will ask you about the most intimate part of your body just because pregnant.
Yeah, it's a huge invasion of your privacy. And I remember, I mean, this is sort of sad to say, but one of the traumas of my pregnancy was doing a public ultrasound with all my nieces and nephews and my mother and father-in-law, with my brother-in-law performing the ultrasound for everybody.
Oh, my God.
And I was like, why did I agree to this? And then afterwards, I was so angry and upset and, like, felt humiliated. And, my husband just couldn't understand the level of my emotion. And I was just like, you know what? It's just, I can't even explain it to you if you don't just get it, you know?
Well, you probably also, I mean, there's this way in which the woman herself disappears for a little while. You know, you're the vessel for the baby. You know, it's like the attention is all on the baby inside you, your wallpaper.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. It's this idea that there's this complete elimination of self, of the woman, and all value placed on this unborn child. So it very much seems to be out of balance.
So is this why you created this town full of fierce girls? And Mercy Lewis, the main character in the novel, you described her as a badass. Was that kind of your answer to the religious right? Take this.
Well, you know, she is so ferocious, and I love how physically strong she is, mentally tough. But the book shows that even a young woman as remarkable as Mercy eventually can succumb to all of these pressures and these expectations placed on her, even somebody whose life seems to be perfect from the outside. But I do think, you know, she also has the resources to recover. And, you know, not to spoil anything, but the book definitely ends on a hopeful note for her. And I do think that it's that inner strength that she and Illa and Annie all possess, sort of despite their surroundings.
I read something you wrote, or no, maybe it was an interview. Somebody asked you about writing badass girl characters.
Mm-hmm.
Can you recap what does make a badass girl character?
That was the best question I've ever received.
I know, so I had to steal it. Sorry.
You know, I think what makes a badass is fearlessness. So these girls who step on the court and just own it, they know they can dominate. And I just love that through sports, girls can have those moments of not having to apologize for their toughness and their unrelenting fierceness. So I think badasses, you know, it's sort of when you can embrace that fearlessness and sort of push back against some of these societal stereotypes or expectations. That, to me, defines a badass.
Kaya Parsonen talking about her novel, The Unraveling of Mercy Lewis. And that's it for today's show. But if it sparked any thoughts or ideas that you'd like to share, why not comment on our Facebook page? To the Best of Our Knowledge comes to you from Wisconsin Public Radio. Charles Monroe Kane produced this hour, with help from Raymond Tungekar, Craig Ely, Doug Gordon, and Emma Ryskowski. Our theme music comes from Steve Mullen from Walk West Music. Kirill Owen is our technical director. Steve Paulson is our executive producer, and I'm Anne Strainchamps. Thanks for listening.
PRI, Public Radio International.